Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is Simon Lambert for a Managing Your Money Poddy special. From budgeting and saving to investing and pensions, are we doing better than we think? What can you do yourself? When should you get help? A financial advisor, planner, or wealth manager? How rich do you need to be to seek advice? And is it just for the old? So many questions, we'll answer a fair few of them. Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, depending on which study you want to read, 30, 40, 50%, I've seen it all, Brits say they lack the confidence to manage their money. Either way, it's a lot of us lacking confidence. Now, obviously, our podcast listeners are already well ahead of the pack. But are you confident to make every financial decision? Are you overconfident in some areas? When is the information you receive here enough? It's not advice, by the way, it's information. And when do you need to head to the experts? Well, Simon, this is what you and I are going to discuss today. But why?
Because I think it's always good to have a think about this kind of stuff. And to sit down and consider, okay, what am I actually doing with my money? How am I managing my money? How good am I at it? And we've talked about this on the podcast before. People have different relationships with their finances. For some people, they're totally on top of it. They're super organized. For some people, it's something to be really scared about and they prefer to adopt the tactic of somewhat sticking their head in the sand and ignoring their finances and hoping that they just turn out okay. And then for the bulk of people, they're somewhere in the middle. There's stuff that they do. There's stuff that they know they should be doing and they don't do. And there's stuff that they never do at all. And I think that it's always good to just have a think about what you are doing. Are you making your money work as hard as possible? And also, why are you doing it? What is the point of this whole thing? You know, there'll be people listening to this who are high earners, for example. Or there'll be people listening to this who are really good at saving. They're saving loads of money. Or there'll be people listening to this who aren't actually saving or investing at all. And it's like, if you want to be doing those things, why are you doing them? What do you aspire to? Is there any point in just earning loads of money for the sake of it? Is there any point in just saving loads of money for the sake of it? Is there any point in investing money just for the sake of it? Or do you want to have something that you're aiming for at the end of it? Whether it's an actual thing, you know, people saving for a deposit for a home, people investing for a more comfortable retirement, or whether it's a life goal. It's that thing that we talk about. And I think has become a really big thing for people of a certain age of the, maybe when I'm in my mid-50s, I'd like to be able to take a step back, work on my own terms, go travel, enjoy life while I'm still hopefully fit, healthy, and do something that means that I'm not doing the 9 to 5 every day until my state pension kicks in at 67, 68, who knows.
I'm glad you said that. It's about the why are we doing the things, because I've sort of thought in my head, is this about psychology so much of this? And I'm curious when we hear these statistics, because when we do, it's there's loads of research that's sort of like, how confident are we with managing our money? And I'm always a bit dubious about any sort of research that asks us questions about what we think about the way we are with money, because oftentimes we're quite wrong. Sometimes we overplay how confident we are, we underplay how confident we are. What do you think? Are we doing better? Are we doing worse? Are we better in some areas? Why do we think, a large proportion of us think, that we are lacking in confidence when it comes to money? What is it about money?
Well, it's in scarce supply and you never seem to have enough of it, which is a definite problem. And that is going to be something that people feel even more at the moment, coming off the back of a couple of years of really high inflation. The cost of living crisis and all that. Now, inflation has dropped back down to pretty much on target 2%. And we are in what would be termed a disinflationary environment. But disinflationary doesn't mean things are getting cheaper. That's deflationary. Disinflationary just means they're not getting more expensive as quick as they were. And I think many people will still look at things like their supermarket shop, the energy bills that are about to start rolling in as the heating goes on, the cost of just doing some things that we all enjoy. Going out for dinner is so expensive now. The cost of a pint in the pub, the cost of going to the cinema. And they think, well, I mean, this is just like costing me so much money. Where is my money going? So I think there is that issue. But I also think that people are probably better at managing their money than they think. And I think we're probably on a better track than maybe we could have been. We can talk about pensions later, but auto enrollment, I think, has made a massive difference to the number of people who are just putting a bit of money aside every month for their pension pot. And the earlier you start, the better it is and the bigger difference it makes. So that, I think, is good. If you look at the statistics, actually, about the amount of cash savings that we have as a nation, it's pretty high. I mean, it's pretty amazing, but that is skewed very much towards the older generation. I think the younger generation are very switched on with their finances, though. There'll be people listening to this in their 20s, you know, in their 30s. And a lot of those people are really, really switched on. And it's very easy to find information about how to, you know, what you can do, how to manage your money, how to get a mortgage, how to sort it out, how to find the best savings account, all that kind of stuff. Come to thisismoney.co.uk. Obviously, you'll find it there. But even if you go somewhere else, it's very easy to find that stuff. And there's lots of apps, services, websites there to help people. I mean, if you just go to your bank or building society's website, there'll be infinite amounts of tools and guides and things like that. So it's all out there, but it's just about taking advantage of it and just making maybe some small changes that would make a world of difference to how well you're actually doing. And in some cases, taking things out of your hands and just putting it into someone else's or automating it or something.
Right, so we're going to talk about savings, investing, pensions. I want to run through and ask you, out of 10, for each of those areas, how you currently rate yourself, i.e. where do you think you're lacking? So,
all right, you're getting that back.
Oh, that's
I'm
fine.
Asking you that same question back, Georgie Frost.
Savings, cash savings, Simon, out of 10, how would you rate your situation?
Okay, I would rate my cash savings situation now, not as in how big a balance do I have, just as in how well am I doing and kind of making sure I'm on top of it. I would currently rate my cash savings situation as a 9, right?
Ooh.
But that is only now. I would rate my cash savings situation 2 years ago as a 5, to be honest. So at the moment, my cash savings are in cash ISA, so I'm not paying any tax on the interest. A flexible cash ISA, so I can take the money out and I can pay it back in within the same tax year without losing any of my that year's ISA allowance. And I think these flexible cash ISAs are the best possible easy access account that you can have. And that's where the bulk of, you know, my readily available cash savings is. And then my emergency pot money is in premium bonds, right? I've just chosen to keep it there. The rate's not guaranteed, but I could get that money really quickly if I needed to. You can get your money out of the premium bonds in 1 or 2 days. Mm. And I think that the advantage of the premium bonds is there's just enough of a hurdle to getting at the money that means you can't just take the money out and use it, which is a good place for an emergency pot. But why would I say it's now a 9 compared to a 5? Right, a 9 because of the things I said, cash ISA, flexible, all that kind of stuff, round about the best rate on the market. A 5 because a couple of years ago, before we basically did a load of work that involved pretty much building a house, we had moved house and then we had cash set aside to do that. And we made the mistake of ending up with quite a lot of that cash in taxed savings accounts.
Got it.
And some of it, you know, wasn't on the best rate. And rates were low at that point, so you weren't getting very good returns on your savings, but we're still ending up paying tax on some of them, so should have been in an ISA. And then when rates started to rise, it started to become really quite painful. So if I'd have stuck that money into ISAs and made sure it was on better rates, then I would have done much better. So Georgie, cash savings, where are you at?
Well, 2. out of 10. I'll give my cash.
Oh, Georgie.
I know. But I'm also someone who would underplay it. I forgot about premium bonds. Yeah, I have premium bonds. So there you go. Well done, me. The reason that my savings and investing, I think I would rate as around 2 or 3, is because I would rate my pension as a 10. I have absolutely prioritized that and buying a house. I've recently just bought a house. And this is where we're going to speak to a financial advisor later. At which point can you take your foot off the gas and start focusing on other areas in life? And also, I have a business account. So I do have some money in there, but you wouldn't call it cash savings because it's just being eroded by inflation. And I have to pay to have the account. So it's not a very sensible thing to do. But I'm like so many people that you go, well, as a self-employed person, you need to keep it there just in case, just in case, just in case. So the questions I would ask a financial advisor or planner would be related to tax advice. And then the question I'd be asking, this is money, would be about my day-to-day. I'm not very good at the day-to-day. As soon as I've got this plan, like so many people, I'm going to start saving. I'm going to be really good. It's a bit like a diet. I'm not going to eat bread or whatever. And then as soon as I do, I'm like, oh, sod it. So what I would need is financial planner for tax and also protection. I did go to a financial planner and they said the one thing that's lacking is any sort of insurance, income protection insurance, anything like that.
And I think you make a really good point there because you are self-employed and it is harder if you are self-employed. And I think that's something that we need to recognise and think about. And it's something that if you are self-employed, you need to think about yourself, is that I'm in the position where I get paid the same amount every month, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, my wages come in and then I try to take the money out. The money comes out of my account that goes for our mortgage. Money comes out of my account that goes for our joint account for like the monthly spending for the family. Money comes out of my account and gets put into savings. And that's the amount of money that I'm trying to hopefully save that month. Now, where I'm making a mistake with all these things is they are not automated. It's not set up as a direct debit or a regular payment. So I have to remember to do them, which, you know, it's surprising how many times you can suddenly go, oh my God, I need to move that money in to pay the mortgage. Definitely with the saving and investing, that would pay off. But I'm in that position and then, you know, my work pension looks after itself kind of thing, which we'll talk about later. But if you are self-employed, you're responsible for doing that yourself and your income is lumpy, isn't it? Some months you're like, woohoo. And some months it's like, where is my money? And you do have to keep money aside. You have to keep money aside for your tax bill. And you have to keep money aside because you're like, well, that's my pot for the months when I don't get paid and I need to draw on it for my income and things like that. My wife is in a similar position because she's self-employed. She's a sole trader. But what you can do, I think, is you know, that money that you're putting aside for tax or that money that you're putting aside for the business, there's no reason not to be earning any interest on it. And in fact, that you could get that into a savings account that is earning interest, and then at least you know that you're not just losing it to inflation, like you said.
Okay, so that's what I need to do really quickly then, Simon, because we're going to go into each of these in more detail. But how would you rate your investing? If it's not 10 out of 10, get off the show, Simon.
Oh, it's nowhere near 10 out of 10. It's like a 6 out of 10. So I'm in the fortunate position where I've managed to build up quite a healthy investment pot in my stocks and shares ISA, and that's great, and it's in a stocks and shares ISA, so you know, all good. But the investments in there are a right hodgepodge mix of stuff that's been picked up over the years. There's things from when I decided to get into stock picking and build up a share portfolio. There's lots of mainly investment trusts and then some funds, and then you look at some of them, you're like, why did I even buy that? Why are they still there? That's the question. And then there's probably like 50 or 60 holdings in it. You can't keep track of all that stuff. Wow. And also, actually, once you look at the performance, I probably would have been better just putting most of it into a global tracker fund, which says a lot about how global tracker funds have performed, mainly due to US stock market returns and the fact that everyone's been worried about US stock market being too expensive for ages, but it keeps going up. But if I'd have just done it a lot more simpler, I would have made more money. So yeah, I'd only give it a 6 on that basis.
I'm hoping by the end of this that I will be in that cohort of people that are actually doing better than they think they are. Pensions?
8 or 9 maybe.
Oh yeah.
Because I've been saving into my work pension every month for the last nearly 20 years. If you do that, that really does start to pay off. I started as soon as I started at This Is Money when I was a reporter, and obviously I earned less then, but the percentage of my salary going in is the same then as it is now, and it compounds up and does really well. But again, actually, I think I made the mistake of picking funds myself rather than going for the kind of default option. And I think maybe just the default option probably might have delivered better returns over that time.
Protection. I mean, you wrote will after you.
Hey, yeah, I've got a will.
Complaining.
Right, I've got a will. It took a while, but I've got a will. I've got life insurance, which is important because I've got children and a mortgage. And I don't have income protection insurance, but obviously I'm employed, so I have a notice period. I have an emergency pot set aside. So probably actually, if you talk to financial advisors, they do say you should have income protection insurance, but I don't have it. But then I do have quite a large buffer zone.
Right. So a good 7, would you say there, Simon? 7, 8?
Yeah, 8.
Yeah.
8. Yeah.
Okay. So if you do go to in front of a financial advisor, planner, whoever, what would be your area?
What would be my area? I think the questions would be more about the how do I get to where I want to get to kind of thing, and how do I think about this more? And obviously I'm in a slightly weird position because I'm not a professional in terms of, you know, financial planning or financial advice or anything like that, but I literally live and breathe this stuff on a daily basis, you know, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, alarmingly quite a lot of the 24-hour day, you know, might have thoughts about money and everything popping up into my head. So when you're having those conversations with financial planners, and I've done things like, you know, money MOT and things like that before, you have to say, look, by the way, you know, you do say, like, my job is this, and I do know a lot of the kind of stuff. So a lot of the stuff they'd be explaining anyway, but it's more like, actually, come on, Mr. Lambert, I'd say, call me Simon. What are you doing here? You've got this investment ISA. It's a decent pot, but if you really want that to grow to the point where you can use that for what you want to use it for, if you want to be heading off to the mountains snowboarding, you know, when you're in your mid-50s and your children have left home and your mortgage is paid off, then you can't just have this hodgepodge mix of investments because, like, they haven't delivered over the last 10 years as well as they could have done. So why on earth do you think they're going to deliver over the next 10? So maybe it's some of that stuff.
Right, well, let's go through it, shall we? From the top, Simon, I do want to know, just before we get into the savings and stuff, I mentioned about psychology, that old chestnut, look after the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves. Okay, so what is the best way to manage your money day to day? Go.
So I think that there is no right answer to the best way to do this. It is ultimately budgeting, which sounds like an absolute snooze fest. I'm fully aware, but that can be as simple as just working out where your money is going every month. You can sit down and do this with a pen and a piece of paper. You could probably do it going for a walk and thinking, but I would say you ideally need to be able to access your internet banking or your app. And we've talked about wandering around, holding your phone out with your banking app open on other shows. So don't do that. Don't do that. But you just need to know where it's going every month, like how much is coming in, and then how much is going out, but what's going on mortgage or rent? What's going on your groceries? What's going on your bills? What's going on the cost of your commute? Those things that you have to pay for, then how much are you then spending on yourself? Takeaways, going out for dinner, you know, doing that kind of stuff, doing fun stuff. And what's the kind of ratio? And that's where I do think, not that I think it's the best way to do it, but things like having a look at it in the framing of like the 50-30-20 budget thing, 50% on essentials, 30% on wants, 20% into savings. Having a look at it in that kind of framework and seeing roughly where do I stand? Where's it all going? Because once you know where it's all going, you can then start to work out how much you can save and how you can save more. And it could be that you could save some money on some of the essentials. It could be that you might go, I am spending how much on my grocery shopping? Or you're doing what I am an absolute menace for, is internet shop for the groceries, try to keep the cost of that down, pretty frugal on that. And then a certain person goes off to Waitrose. All Sainsbury's at the weekend to buy some food for dinners, and all of a sudden we've doubled our grocery bill.
I do the same. It's exactly the same. All right. So actually, I'd say one of the most useful tools that I have, and you mentioned it earlier, was on my bank account, Starling. It has a spending tool. It lets me categorize. So I spend a little time just working out like where everything is going. It doesn't help me stop, you know, but at least I've taken the first step. Hello, my name is Georgie. I need to manage my money better. I've got the app. It's just taking that next step. Let's talk about
And there are those occasions when you think, I'm going to go to the supermarket to get food for dinner because I'm not going to have a takeaway because that's expensive. And then you spend so much money in the supermarket at the weekend that you're like, I actually would have been cheaper if I just had the takeaway and kept myself out of the supermarket.
There are some areas, though, and I think this is really important when we talk about managing our money. There are some areas where I wouldn't cut back on. And there are some areas where I can easily cut back on. Because if I try and get rid of all of the fun stuff in life, I'm never going to succeed.
Where's your priority? That's really important. Yeah, that's really important. That you have to spend some money. You have to enjoy it. You've got to enjoy it on the way. We talked about the FIRE movement before, haven't we? And said, you know, actually, it doesn't really work for most people. You've got to enjoy your life along the way.
Okay, so let's talk about saving. Around 30%, according to the FCA, of people in the UK have no savings at all. One in three have less than £1,000 put away. Another 18% have less than £5,000. Yet we all need a rainy day pot. So, Simon, how do you get into the habit? How much do you really need? We hear this 3 to 6 month figure, which can be quite intimidating. And then, of course, there are different accounts, which you mentioned earlier, for different requirements. So let's get into that, the habits.
The first thing I would say is that old get the money out of your account as soon as you get paid thing. And if you can automate that, all the better, because it means that you don't have to remember to do it yourself. And then by the time you get around to doing it, you've already spent £500 and you're looking at it going, I don't actually have enough money to put that money into savings this month. Maybe I'll just skip this month and so on and so on. So try to automate it, be that, you know, regular payment, direct debit, however you do it. I would try to do that. I would try to make it a realistic amount. You can make it an unrealistic amount, but if the amount is so unrealistic that every month you have to go dipping back into the savings pot to take money out, is that working? Are you just building up a habit of dipping into your savings pot? Or actually, maybe you're okay with that because you're like, I'd rather be ambitious and then take £100 of it back at the end of the month than be under ambitious and not save enough. Just think about how you want to do it. And I would say, first place, Cash ISA. Easy access, Cash ISA, flexible one. Ideally, some of them have got some of the best rates on the market. Pay the money in, you don't pay any tax on your savings, and you can take the money out if you need it, but then you can put it back in if you want to replenish it. A lot of people will just use a standard easy access account, but you've got to be aware the personal savings allowance is only £1,000 now. It's only £500 for higher rate taxpayers, and it's nothing if you're an additional rate taxpayer. So there'll be people listening to this who get no personal savings allowance whatsoever, and so just use an ISA instead. If you've got a big pot, 3 to 6 months, they say, should be the emergency pot. 6 months post-tax wages is so much money. It's no wonder people look at this and go, what? How? You need to think about how much protection have you got in place in case you do lose your job or something happens. Maybe you could get away with the three. That money needs to be easily accessible. You need to be able to get it if you need it. If you've got cash savings beyond that, substantial amounts, then you can consider a fixed rate account where generally you will get a better rate for locking up your money for longer. But that's not actually the case at the moment. You'll get a better rate on easy access, but those rates on easy access could come down, whereas your fixed rate will stay the same. Fixed rate savings are so popular amongst our readers on This Is Money. They absolutely love their fixed rate savings. And the only thing I would say is if you are willing to lock your savings away for 3 years or 5 years, maybe you should be asking yourself, should I be investing the money instead?
We'll get on to that in a second. I was thinking that perhaps This Is Money listeners and readers would have the flip reverse of this problem. It's not how to get started, how to motivate yourself, etc. It would be having too much in savings, too much in their cash savings. So when do you stop saving even more and start investing?
That's a really good question. And it's one that lots of people struggle with. And actually, the way to make it as hard as possible for yourself is to save up a really, really big pot. And then you just worry a lot about investing that money and the fact that it could go down substantially once you've invested it. And investing a big lump sum is more risky in some cases than investing regularly, because if the market does take a tumble, then you're going to take a hit. Now, obviously, the flip side could occur and the market could shoot up and you get really, really lucky. So actually, the returns from investing a big lump sum can be quite good. But the mental risk factor is definitely higher. So once you've got that emergency pot saved, start thinking about investing and maybe do the thing where you go, okay, I'm going to put aside £400 a month. I've been putting aside £400 a month. I think I should probably start investing some of the money now. You don't have to do it all into an investment account, into a stocks and shares ISA. You could go, right, I'm just going to dip my toe and I'm going to go 200, 200, and I'm going to see how it goes. And then if I'm comfortable with it, maybe I'll up the percentage and start to put more into the investment account. And I think the mistake people make is they think about this stuff in terms of polar opposites, black and white, saving, investing. It's not, yeah. It's a spectrum. You're running along a line between the two, and you don't have to put yourself at the far end of that line. You could put yourself in the middle of the line. You could put yourself a bit more to the comfortable end of the line, and then you don't have to stay at that point. You can move along it. And if you don't like it where you've moved to, you can move back.
Is there an easy way to go about investing?
There are some really easy ways to go about investing. It has literally never been easier to do it. It has also never been easier to take very high risk attitudes to investing that could lose you substantial amounts of money. So try to differentiate between those two things, okay? It's never been easier to open an account and buy some crypto. Not really necessarily investing, wouldn't recommend it. It's never been easier to open a share trading account and start trading individual shares yourself. Again, probably wouldn't recommend that for beginners. You need a diversified portfolio of at least 15 to 20 stocks. They need to do different things so they don't all rise and fall together. And you need to dedicate the time to properly researching those companies, understanding what they do, the valuations and so on. Most people just don't have time to do that. But what you can do is you can open up an account at an investment platform. You can start investing very easily. And the hurdle, there are two hurdles when it comes to it. People don't open the accounts. But once you get over that hurdle, there's another one that the investment platforms will tell you a lot of their customers get stuck at, and that's the then actually investing their money, paying their money in and actually investing their money. Because people worry about the investments that they choose, and they don't necessarily worry about choosing the absolute best investment. They worry about choosing one that's going to lose the money and be a duffer, that they loss aversion, major factor.
Yeah.
But you don't worry too much about that. You could just choose a really simple investment fund, a tracker fund or an ETF, global stock market tracker, and you just follow the global market and you rely on the ability of companies making money and rewarding shareholders either through dividends or through their share price going up. And the winners continue to do that and the losers drop out of the index and on you go. And that's the core bit of your portfolio. Or you could go for something where you have something like the Vanguard Life Strategy Funds, where it mixes a certain percentage of shares and a certain percentage of bonds. And basically, the more risk you're happy taking, you do more shares versus bonds. Again, really simple, pretty much a tracker fund. Lots of the investment platforms have model portfolios where their experts have picked a portfolio and you just go, I think that portfolio is the right one for me. And I'm going to pay my money into it. And many of them have risk profiling tools where you can basically answer some very simple questions about what sort of investor you might be. And it says, you're probably this kind of investor, and this is the kind of thing that people like you might want to go for. And it's dead simple. And you could do it on your phone, on your laptop, sat on the sofa. You know, as we said, don't do it walking down the street because someone might nick your phone.
And also, you'll be that annoying person down the street on your phone. Get off your phone.
And you have to go back a couple of podcasts to listen to us ranting about people wandering around tube stations on phones, watching Netflix and stuff like that. Yeah, we don't like that.
No need. Not good for you. Not good for anyone else. So it's a little bit, Simon, it could be like opening a savings account you set up. You know, some money to go out every month. You tell them what you want. Sit back. Let it go.
Yeah, steady.
It could be as simple as that.
It could be £50 a month. It could be £100 a month. It's in some of them will let you invest less than that regularly. I would question why you would want to invest £1 a month.
Things to check. Obviously, this is money, I assume. have lots of information about sort of the best platforms to use, but things to check like fees, those sorts of things.
Yep. What are they charging you? What does it do? What's the customer service like? How much help is it giving you? And if you are absolutely dead set on having the cheapest possible platform and you don't need any help whatsoever, that's fine. But if you think I'd like some help and I'm willing to pay a bit more money for it, that's also fine. Horses for courses. If you go to thisismoney.co.uk/platforms, you'll find our guide to the best and cheapest DIY investment platforms and what you need to think about in terms of charges. The main charges are basically charges for the account and charges for buying and selling investments. And then you've also got the cost of the underlying investments, but the platform doesn't control that last bit.
The best financial advice, can I call it advice? It wasn't really advice. It wasn't qualified. The financial advisors don't own that word. But the best tip I got when it comes to finances was just get started. And it was related to my pension, but you could argue the same thing with, you know, an investment platform, for example. You know, go, if you've never done it before, go simple. And then when you get more engaged and more interested, then you can start doing things yourself if you want to. Just turn 30, just get started. If you want to know more about pensions, by the way, obviously you will have listened to Sir Steve's epic show a couple of weeks ago, but listen back for a pensions refresher. But so bear in mind, you know, I'm only 32 now, Simon. You know, that's not a lot of time in which I've managed to get to a level 9 or 10 for my pension. I'm not 32, that's for sure. But we sit here smug in our high-ranking pensions. But it all started for me by just getting started. I've got more engaged and I have prioritised my pension. So what tips do you have here beyond the just getting started, go to This Is Money, find platforms, etc., etc.? What do we need to know here, Simon, that Sir Steve didn't cover a couple of weeks ago?
So firstly, you had to do this yourself because you're self-employed. If you're self-employed, you need to go Indeed. Do this yourself, right?
Yep.
Just do it. Open a SIP, self-invested personal pension, sort it out. It's like opening an investment account. If you're not self-employed, which most people are not self-employed, you will be offered a workplace pension. And your work pension is the easiest way to get rich long term. Basically, the two simplest ways most people will have of building their wealth in their life are their work pension and buying a house with a repayment mortgage. Buying a house with a repayment mortgage works not because house prices always go up, which they don't, but because it's like a really good long-term savings scheme. Someone allows you to live in a house, which is something that largely speaking, most people need to do, a house or a flat, they need somewhere to live. And for a small amount every month, they will lend you a colossal amount of money, far more than you could ever save up to buy that property. You pay it back slowly over the years with some interest, and the interest rate is very low compared to the interest you'd have on almost anything else in your life. And at the end of it, you own a home that's worth hundreds of thousands of pounds outright. Brilliant long-term savings scheme, right? Your pension, there is quite a heavy barrier though to getting that house. Like, house prices are way too high compared to wages in this country at the moment. Your work pension, on the other hand, is dead easy because you start with putting a small amount of money in. And if you put a small amount of money in, your employer will put some money in as well, and the government will give you some money too. And that's a really good deal. Most people will be auto-enrolled into something called a defined contribution pension, which is where they invest money to build up a pot that they then have to use to supply their own income in retirement. Some lucky people, mainly who work in the public sector, because you don't get much of these in the private sector anymore, will be offered something called a defined benefit pension. This is where your employer guarantees to pay you a guaranteed income in retirement, and you accrue it for every year that you work there. So for example, you know, 1/40th of your average salary while you're working there for each year that you work there. If someone offers you a defined benefit pension, take it. Just don't even question it, just take it. These things are really quite valuable. You know, if you are in a defined benefit pension scheme, think about that. You know, think about the fact that, you know, it really is quite valuable to it. But defined contribution ones, this is where auto-enrollment comes in. And basically what happens is when you start work, your employer will auto-enroll you into a pension. You can choose not to join it. You can opt out, but the default is that you are opted in. And this has made an absolute game-changing difference to the amount of people saving for a pension. The current rules are that you pay in 5% as a worker, the employer tops it up by 3%, and then the government will also pay some tax relief on the money that you put in. Most employers will actually offer better pension schemes than the auto-enrollment minimum, but you might have to join it. You might have to sign up for it. So if you get a letter from your employer that says, you know, you've just joined pensions, auto-enrollment, we've got this pension scheme as well, and we'll match your contributions, make sure you join that one. Don't just accidentally think you'll automatically go into it. And the great thing about this is that, to put some numbers on it, underwater enrolment, someone earning £30,000 a year could get £231 into their pension each month at a cost of just £125 to them. So worker pays in 5% of their £2,500 monthly earnings, £125. That's the cost to them. Their employer tops it up by 3%. So that's an extra £75 on top. And the government adds £31.25 in pension tax relief. And the magic of compounding means that if you do that for 30 years and you get an average 6% return, you'd end up with £233,000. Great. But if you do it for 40 years, so only 10 years longer, your pot would end up being worth £460,000. That's the difference the extra 10 years makes. So when you start work in your mid-20s, join the pension, pay into the pension, because the 10 years between your mid-20s and your mid-30s is going to make a whacking great difference at the back end of it.
Absolutely. All right, so let's just say you've done all the above. What next? When do you get help? Financial planner Dan Beecroft from Charles Stanley Direct is here. Dan, what's the difference, firstly, between financial planning and financial advice? And then we're going to throw all sorts of things in, like tax advisors, wealth managers, all sorts of things. But what's the difference?
I'd say the two are quite closely related, but there are some differences. So quite often you might get an IFA who will do both. But financial planning is generally thinking bigger picture. Mm-hmm. So the focus is more about implementing a long-term strategy. So taking a holistic approach, looking at the full financial picture. And that'll be everything from budgeting, savings, you mentioned sort of tax, insurance, retirement and estate planning. Financial advice is much more short term. So it's more about focusing on a specific area of the plan and making recommendations and probably implementing some sort of investment strategy or asset allocation.
So say, Dan, I come to you and I want a holistic view. You know, I'm in my 40s. I want to make sure that my finances are going to sort me until the end of my days, right? So that's financial planning. I get that. But let's say the area of concern is pensions. Would a financial planner do that, or would I have to get a separate financial advisor?
I guess it depends on the financial advisor and the service that they're offering, because you can get one-off advice. And it might be that you have come at it at a certain point. So for instance, you've said you want to focus on retirement planning. It might be that you want cash flow modeling. You want an idea as to what sort of retirement you'll be able to afford and how much you should be saving towards retirement. And that might be a one-off exercise. It might not be that that's what you actually need, because as you just said, there's a lot more to financial planning than specifically an area that you focused on. But it is possible to get advice on just that one specific area.
What do people come to you about the most? Because I asked at the start, do you need to be rich and do you need to be old?
You don't need to be rich. Certainly don't need to be old. I'm sure you guys have said before, the benefits of starting early will make a huge impact later on in life. So definitely, we get an awful lot of younger investors and they come to us generally with the question about investing. So it might be less experienced clients that are coming to you looking for some sort of guidance as to what investment they should be going into. Now, typically, investing is the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's crucial that they should have a solid financial foundation before diving into investing. So ensuring that they've got the basics covered, so budgeting, income, expenses, any debt that they might have, building a sufficient emergency fund. They're all the sort of fundamentals to have in place before jumping into investing sort of conversation and, you know, risk and time horizons and goals and objectives.
I'm not going to ask you this, Dan, because I don't think it's fair. But Simon, how much does it cost? What is a reasonable amount to pay? What should you expect for your money?
The cost varies. I think it's one of those things that always annoys people when they go looking for financial advice or financial planning, and there isn't just a price list or just a, it will cost you this, because that's what people are used to, very much so, you know, in the modern age. And I would argue it's quite important, because there's a reason why lots of people freak out when they go into somewhere like a butcher's or a greengrocer's or a fishmonger's, and it's just, you know, there's a price per kilogram or per pound, but they're like, I don't know how much that's actually going to be. I like things with a price tag on it, so I know exactly how much it's going to cost me. I'm leaving. So I think that is an issue, maybe. But it's often done potentially for the financial advice stuff. If it's a one-off piece of financial advice, you could pay, you know, a monetary amount, or it might be based on a percentage of the value of what you're doing. Sorting your pension, for example, could cost you a few £1,000. But the argument is that the value of that advice, the long-term lifetime value of that advice, would vastly outweigh the cost. Financial planning is often done on, you know, a percentage of your assets under management basis. And it could be, you know, 1.5%, 2%, something like that. But what should happen is that before you sign up to anything, you will have a meeting with an advisor, with a financial planner. They'll explain, you know, they'll find out about your finances, they'll explain the kind of things they can do to help you. And then they will say to you, you know, if we were to move on with this, this is what it would cost you. And if at that point you don't understand anything, or you don't understand the fees, you're not quite sure what it's going to cost you, that is the time when you need to be asking lots of questions and making sure that before you sign up, you know exactly what you're going to be paying. And also, hopefully, they will give you evidence of how signing up for that financial planning will then, you know, make a difference to your finances, a material difference to your finances, that shows how much, you know, it's going to add to your potential wealth over time. And again, it's the kind of thing where getting that financial planning could make quite a substantial difference to how your wealth and your, you know, investments grow. But it could also be, as Dan said, that basically you might be making a couple of mistakes that's costing you a fortune in tax each year, and the amount that you pay for the financial planning is going to be saved just by the fact that you're not paying so much more in tax than you need to be paying.
Dan, if I was to come to you as a newbie, Simon sort of intimated the questions that you'd ask, but you are the expert, what would you try and find out?
So very much get to know you and your situation, what you are looking for. We said before, people come with a specific idea in their mind, what they want to talk about. But generally, from a financial advising perspective anyway, it's learning about you and your financial situation and your goals. Short term, medium term, long term, what is it that you are looking to do? Is the things that you've not considered, which a financial advisor will be able to look at. Once you've got over sort of an initial conversation, when you do dive into the finances and you complete a fact find, you get an awful lot of information about that individual, and you'll be able to sort of help them navigate, prioritize their goals, objectives, and work towards it.
What are some of the common things that perhaps people do wrong? We mentioned earlier about the first time I ever went to a financial planner. Well, there were two things. One, he sort of turned me away. And the reason he did is because I was like, I couldn't decide if I wanted to have kids, which is quite a big thing, I understand, when it comes to your finances and your future. So I was in that sort of process. And he said, when you've made the decision, maybe come back. And the other thing he said was, you don't have any protection insurance. I had nothing should I lose my job, and I am self-employed. So that was an issue. Is that a common occurrence?
Yeah, there are a few things, and it will vary from different types of clients as to what they're doing wrong. Again, I come back to the fact that mainly we get inquiries regarding people investing, because they've come through our investing platform and they've got queries about that. I think people probably put too much thought and effort and concern into their actual investments. Obviously, the most important thing that you've discussed is getting started with investing and putting money in, but it's the savings mechanism. It's making it sort of habitual and you know, direct debit into your stocks and shares ISA or your pension, whatever it might be. They're the things that in the long term are going to make the biggest difference to your financial freedom and your retirement planning. It's not so much what you're investing in. And going back to that, if they are investing, an awful lot of people don't put enough thought into how much risk they're prepared to take. We've spoken before, and Simon's mentioned the benefits of investing into index trackers or some sort of lifestyling fund. Those sort of things over long term will probably have a much better performance than investing in individual companies that not a lot of thought or effort has gone into the research behind it. In my opinion, I think investing should be boring. It shouldn't be fun. It shouldn't be that you're logging in every day to see how your investments are performing and worrying that it's gone up 5% or down 5% that day. It should be a slog. It should literally just be something where you set up a regular contribution and you forget about it. And in a year's time, you check on it and you think, oh, that's doing quite well. You know, my wages have gone up. I'll put more money into that. I'll contribute £10 extra a month. That is what, in my mind, investing should be and how people should approach it. But what they actually tend to do is, as you've seen before, people like to hear about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and think that that's where they should be investing and take all sorts of unnecessary risks that they don't need to.
Right. So boring, slow and steady wins the race. Dan, thank you so much for your time.
All right. Pleasure.
Simon, Stat of the Week is back. This week it is.
How long does it take to sell a home, and where is the quickest place in the UK to sell a home right now? It currently takes 60 days on average. So where's the quickest place?
I reckon it is Manchester and 35 days.
Ooh, okay. Regionally, we've got Scotland, 33 days. Very interesting. Okay. Now, Scotland obviously has slightly different systems with many things, including offers of binding there pretty much. So maybe that's an outlier. If you skip Scotland and exclude it, then the Northeast, your old stomping ground,
yeah,
at 52 days. Okay. But the slowest place in the country is currently Brixham, down in the southwest, 118 days to get a property under offer after it's been listed on the market. And that's only the ones that actually go under offer. You've got to remember, there'll be the ones that don't go under offer. And the quickest one outside of Scotland is the area of Whitehall in Bristol, 25 days.
Oh, I was going to say Bristol. Brixham, I just had to Google that. It's near Torquay.
It is. It's very nice down there.
No doubt. Just takes a long time to sell a home. All right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. And we'd love to hear your thoughts, actually, on the stuff that we've talked about today, the managing your money, the saving, the investing, and also the financial planning and financial advice stuff. So tell us your stories about this kind of stuff, your tips, your ideas, where it's gone well, where it's gone badly, and we will feature some of them on the show. You can tweet us at This Is Money, and you come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.